Hi, this is Tyler. I'm back for the second part of Chapter 5, Economics 3400, talking about non-tariff trade barriers. We left off talking about voluntary export restraints, and we'll pick up with domestic content requirements. The idea of domestic content requirements is simply in order to avoid tariffs on products coming into the country if a certain percent of that product is the value added is produced in the United States, if we're thinking about the United States, then that product will not be subject to a tariff. For example, maybe if we won't charge a tariff on a Toyota, if a certain percent of the Toyota is manufactured in the United States, so maybe Toyota can set up a factory in Georgia, and although they may buy some of the parts from Japan, if enough of the car, a certain percent is assembled, or other parts are purchased within the United States, then there's no tariffs involved. So it's obviously a government intervention that is intended to stimulate domestic production of the good, as is the case with tariffs, as is the case with import quota. It's a mechanism of limiting imports and somehow trying to stimulate domestic production. Well, how can that be bad? How can you be against that? How can you be against a factory, and how can you be against a government policy that provides incentive for Toyota to build a factory in Georgia and employ Georgian workers? Well, I mean, you've had enough economics now, and you've seen enough of this. What's the problem? Maybe you're sitting in a bar in DeKalb, Georgia, and there's an auto worker in there, and they're going on about, man, sure it is nice that Toyota came here and built a factory. Now I have a job. And maybe you feel so inclined to explain and enlighten this auto worker why maybe it's not in the U.S. as a whole's best interest to have this domestic content requirement. What are you going to say? What are the downsides? Are there any downsides? Surely, by this time, you can articulate the downsides of domestic content requirements. What are they? Well, you could say to this auto worker in DeKalb, Georgia, that, well, yeah, but now Toyotas are more expensive. Toyota can make its cars, if they were left to their own designs, they would make their cars in Tokyo, and we could buy them cheaper. They're forced to come over here, and it's more expensive for them to make Toyotas, and that drives the price up to me. Now I have less money to buy beer, or less money to buy a treadmill made by Icon in Utah. And so not only does it hurt consumers, but because consumers are hurting less and paying more for Toyotas, now that may help that Toyota auto worker in DeKalb, Georgia. But there are other unintended consequences, other effects. And we should be able to guess by now that these unintended, or not, I'm not sure, well, they are unintended. These other effects will outweigh the gain, and there will be a deadweight loss to the United States. Well, let's look at slide, let's put some more meat on this, and look at slide, call up slides again, where'd they go? Call up slide, well, hang on here a second. It's slide, looks like slide 10. It gives us the definition of the domestic content requirements. We've done that. Let's look at the analysis of the domestic content requirement on slide 11. And here they're using as their example, as the domestic country, Australia. This example corresponds to the example presented in the book, as all these slides do. So we have domestic demand in Australia for Toyotas, and we have the supply curve of Toyotas into Japan and Australia. Now there's no domestic supply curve of Toyotas. So what we're thinking here is just Australia buys initially all of its Toyotas coming out of Tokyo, and at $24,000 consumer surplus. is what it is, and producers, there's no producer surplus. There's no production. We're focused on Toyotas. There are no Toyotas manufactured in Australia, so there's no producer surplus associated in Australia with manufacturing Toyotas. Then we impose, hypothetically, a domestic content requirement that shifts entirely the production, or some part of the production of Toyotas, to Australia. And causes the price to go up to 33,000. That supply curve that's horizontal at 33,000 represents the assembled, where the assembly of the cars is taking place in Australia rather than maybe some of it may be coming from Toyota parts, but some the production the assembly is taking place in Australia. Well, you can kind of guess if Toyota was left to its own free will, it would have manufactured the cars in Tokyo. That's our assumption. Originally, all the cars with free trade, no government intervention, the Toyotas were being manufactured in Tokyo. Now, with the domestic content requirement, the threat may have been, to make this example work, the threat may have been that, look, Japan, we're going to impose a huge tariff. So you have your choice between the possibility of a tariff, or if you manufacture these cars in Japan, you can avoid the tariff. And maybe, in fact, there is a tariff on cars that are completely manufactured in Tokyo, and they became maybe they're $50,000, and so they're with a tariff, cars that are manufactured entirely in Tokyo can't be sold. They're not competitive in the Australian market, but these cars that are at least partially manufactured in Australia are competitive. Well, they are the cars that are sold, 33,000. Australians can't buy cars at 24,000 because we're assuming behind the scenes there's a very large tariff on cars that come from Tokyo. Cars that are partially manufactured in Australia are more expensive. They're 33,000, and that's the price, but they're less expensive than the cars coming from Tokyo that are faced with a tariff. Now, I don't remember if in the book there's a tariff or not. But we're assuming behind the scenes there's a very high tariff. It's got to be higher than at least what? You tell me. It's got to be higher than at least $9,000 on the cars manufactured in Tokyo. And so the cars that have to pay the tariff are priced out of the market, and the only cars that are sold in Australia are the ones that are assembled in Australia and sold at $33,000. Well, I hope I haven't confused you on that, but you have to kind of read in what's behind the scene in this example. Well, what are the welfare locks? Welfare losses, welfare effects. Well, you can see initially that consumers lose area A and B. They're paying a higher price and buying fewer cars. Well, the more difficult idea is to think about what's going on with producers in Australia. Is there some gain to producers in Australia? Well, they're producing cars. They're producing 300 cars and selling them, 300 Toyotas and selling them. We only have one car, it's a Toyota. Well, what is the producer surplus? What do producers, what is the productive, is there effect on producers? Well, they went from producing no cars. There are people at work manufacturing Toyota, so there's some benefit to these auto workers and the assembly firm in Australia. Well, what is it? Well, I'll tell you what it is. It's Area A. And how do we get to Area A? Well, total revenue of these cars assembled in or manufactured in Australia is the price of the car, $33,000, multiplied by the 300 cars. It's Area A plus C. But the logic is the cost of the component parts is Area C. And so the net effect on Australian producers is just Area A, which leads to a net loss of area. What? B. Next on our list of non-tariff trade barriers is the issue of subsidies. And as I started the lecture on Chapter 5, I mentioned that this has become a the issue of subsidies has become a huge problem and has caused a stall in the World Trade Organization. Really, a very significant setback in world trade in the World Trade Organization negotiations. If you would just take a minute and call up another page or another browser page. Click on Internet Explorer, whatever browser you're using. Call up another page. I want to take you to a website, if you have this ability. And type in, if you have this page up, type in www.EwgGord. E-W-G. www.EWG. That's EwgGord.org. EWG.org. And click on that. I'll hesitate here a second. EWG. Now mine's up. EWG.org. And this is the webpage of the Environmental Working Group. And I don't get the idea that I'm some kind of whacked out environmentalist, because I'm not. I'm actually just a regular sort of middle of the road conservative economist. These Environmental Working Group, their main point is to demonstrate one of their main points, I'm not sure it's their main point, but what they've done is they've done a good job of advertising, for what it's worth, the extent to which farmers are subsidized around the world. And, by the way, I farm a little on the side, so I'm part of the group feeding at the public trough. But this has become a huge problem in the international trade negotiations. So once you have their homepage, go over to the far right and start scrolling down, and you'll see a little blue area that's called Farm Subsidy Database. You see that? There's a lot of other good stuff on here that you may want to spend some time with. This Farm Subsidy Database, and click on that, and it brings up a map of the United States. Now, what you can do is you can go into any of these states, and you can see by farmer the amount of subsidies they receive. Let's go to California. We don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. In fact, I'm on this list. I live in Idaho, and I, in a very, very small way, just because I have raised some cattle, and every once in a while the government just decides to send some money to people who raise cattle. But if you go to, say, hit on California, which I've just done, once California's up, go over and pick top recipients in 1995, between 1995 and 2003. Click on that. And what that shows you is in California, this gives you the total payments they received from the USDA over that, what is an 8-year period. And you see the first one listed, these are the top recipients. There's the Farmers Rice Co-op, which their headquarters must be in Sacramento, California. Over this 8-year period, they received $134 million in subsidies. I said that right. $134 million. There's also a J.G. Boswell receives over this period $17 million. Dublin Farms, $11 million. Wolfs and Land and Cattle, $11 million. Hanson Ranches, $8 million. Well, you see the extent of subsidies. Well, that's just out of interest. Let's go to Utah. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, and there's nothing immoral about this. In fact, it's well-managed and intelligent people who operate these farms. If the government's going to make subsidies available, who would refuse them? I mean, I'm not saying there's anything immoral about this at all. I just want to point out, for purposes of international economics, I want to motivate that this has become a problem. So I'm going to go back a couple and go into Utah and do the same thing. So go back to your map, click on Utah, and then go to uh, top recipients in 1995-2000. And the top one happens to be located in Logan. It's the Weston Family Partnership. We have the Garn Farm in Fielding. And we have the CV Ranches and Perkins Family Partnership. For some reason, they're listed in Utah, but they have their headquarters in Bancroft, Idaho. You see the top recipients. Maybe you know some of these people. Well, I hope that's motivated you to some extent. But these subsidies have become a problem. Now, what we want to look at first, because what happens is it interferes. Subsidies interfere with prices, and prices interfere with international trade. And what the other countries around the world are complaining is because rich nations subsidize ag. It keeps ag production high. It artificially keeps prices low. And the Indian and the Chinese farmers suffer. And they have, frankly, a good point. Well, back to the matter at hand. Let me see. I think we're... Call up your slides again. And I've sort of lost mine. There we are. We'll go to slide... if you have your slides back, go to slide 12. It tells us there are two types of subsidies. There's a payment made to import competing producers to raise the price they receive above the market price. Well, for lots of the agricultural products, we are import competing. You had rice. Those big farmers in California receive a lot of rice. Dairy products we import. We support dairy farmers. And so, in a way, this is an unfair advantage in the eyes of the exporting countries to domestic producers. We also subsidize exports, which is a little different. Domestic subsidies, just every unit that's produced is subsidized. An export subsidy is focused on exports. Those units that are of the good that are exported are subsidized. Well, in slide 13, we see the welfare effects. And we better move along a little bit. Again, we're going to have this lecture very long. I suppose there's nothing wrong with that. But looking at slide 13, it shows us the welfare effects of a domestic subsidy. Now, the price of the good, if there were no subsidies, it would be the world price of $400. And what are we looking at? We're looking at steel. We're not looking at an agricultural product. We're just looking at steel. $400. And there's domestic demand for steel, and then there's the domestic supply curve without the subsidy, which is the higher line. And at that, with no subsidy, domestic producers would produce 2 units of the good. Domestic consumers would demand 14, and imports would be 12 million tons of steel. Make sure you see that. 12 million tons of steel. Now, the way the subsidy works is for every unit produced, producers get a certain payment from the government. And analytically, that if we want to diagram or model how the effect on supply, it's a downward shift in supply. Supply, from your economics 2010, you should remember that taxes on production shift the supply curve to the left, and subsidies shift the supply curve right or down. I like to think vertically up and down, so it'll shift down by the amount of the subsidy. So we have a $25, in this instance, we're modeling the effect of a $25 per ton subsidy on steel. So really what happens is domestic firms are still going to sell their steel in the domestic market for $400, but they get a $25 subsidy. If that's the case, they're going to supply more steel. And in fact, their production will go out to 7 units and displace 5 million tons of imports. And that's the whole problem from the exporting country's perspective, is these domestic subsidies give the domestic import competing firms an unfair advantage. And we see it right here. It reduces imports. And we could look at the effects on the exporting countries. It hurts them, but it even hurts us. If we look at this, what are the effects? One, There's a cost of the subsidy. The government has to pay these folks the subsidy. For every ton of steel produced, they have to pay them $25. And we saw that in California, somebody received $134 million for producing sugar, based on the sugar some kind of sugar subsidy. Well, the cost of the subsidy is just the number of units produced, 7, multiplied by the $25, or geometrically it's area A and B. There's no effect on consumer surplus in this case. I mean, that is an interesting situation. Domestic consumers are still buying steel at $400. In that sense, the subsidy is perhaps better than a tariff or an import quota. There's no effect on consumers. But there is a cost of the subsidy of A plus B, but there is also an increase in producer surplus. Producers are now receiving, with the subsidy, $425 per ton and selling 7 tons, so their profits or their producer surplus goes up by area A. So producers gain A, but there's the cost of the subsidy of A plus B. So from society's perspective as a whole, there's a net loss of B. Finally, let's talk about international price discrimination or dumping. And if you go to slide 15 just talks about what dumping is in the international trade context. The practice of selling a product at a lower price in export markets than at home. Or there's an alternative definition. There are two ways of thinking about this, or exporting at prices below production costs. One of these, if you think about it, one, remember in your Economics 2010, one of these types of behavior may be nothing more than simple economic optimization, may result from nothing more than economic optimization. If you think back to your Economics 2010, does it ever make any sense to sell from a producer's perspective? Can they maximize profits? Can they increase profits by selling a product at different prices in two different markets? Well, go back to your microeconomics. The answer to that is yes. If they can somehow segment those markets into two discrete markets so consumers can't sell to each other. You can't sell a good in one market for $10, another in $5, because the consumers who buy it for $5 can turn around and sell it for $10, for sell it something less than $10 and make a profit. So you have to have a physically segmented market. But why? Why? I thought profit-maximizing behavior, in which you produce and sell at a point where marginal cost equals marginal revenue, would result in this one price. Well, that's only true if that's not true. If there are different markets which are physically segmented, and there are different demand conditions in those two markets. If there are different demand conditions, there will be different marginal revenue conditions, and it may increase profits for a firm if they sell the good in those two different markets at two different prices. But how about that second notion of dumping, selling or exporting a good at a price below production costs? Now that may be more problematic. Would it ever be profit-maximizing behavior to sell a good below cost? Well, I don't know. It depends on what we mean by production cost, I suppose. But that may be a more sinister practice. The intention may be, by the exporter, to sell it below production costs to drive other firms out of business in order to then raise prices because the firm will have a monopoly. It may be predatory. It's more likely to be predatory. Well, there are a couple other comments there on slide 15, but let's go to slide 16, which is quite a little diagram. And let me go through that just briefly, and that'll be where we'll stop for today. That's about it. If you look at that, and that's a hard one. And that exporter is South Korea, but they also sell the steel in Canada. And they face, again, two different demand conditions. Now, they have a constant cost. They have constant cost, which we mean marginal costs are constant. Marginal costs of producing steel are 200 tons for the South Korean firm. Now, remember from microeconomics that a firm will produce and maximize profits where marginal cost equals marginal revenue. So if we sum demand and we derive the corresponding marginal revenue curve, and we superimpose upon that the marginal cost curve, the firm's marginal cost curve, we find that profits are maximized in total for the South Korean firm of producing 45 units and selling the price of 200. Well, one way of, maybe they won't sell them. I back up it. They don't sell at 200. That's so a non-price discriminating steel producer will produce where marginal revenue equals marginal cost at 45 tons and sell at the homogeneous price of 500 in both markets. But, again, this is a famous, these price discrimination examples, I'm sure you've seen one in 2010, you might want to go back and get your 2010 book. A price discriminating seller facing different demand and marginal revenues in two different markets can increase profits, can maximize profits by selling at a different price. And that price will be the price and quantity that correspond to maximize, the firm will follow a different rule. They maximize profits by, in each different market, setting marginal revenue equals marginal cost. So if you look at this diagram, the far left, focusing on just this Korean market, you see that marginal revenue equals marginal cost at 25 tons of steel, and steel with the corresponding steel price in South Korea would be 700 units. In Canada, on the other hand, the marginal revenue equals marginal cost at 20 units, which corresponds to a price of 400. So they have two different prices. They'd sell at $700 in the domestic market and $400 in the export market. And you could deduce from that, possibly, that, well, by some definitions, the South Korean firm is engaging in dumping. Well, really, what they're, it's nothing more than profit-maximizing behavior. How can that be wrong? Well, legally, it still may. And this whole issue of dumping is also a very interesting legal and economic issue in practice, because there are lots of firms around the world that are continually complaining and lodging legal proceedings against export firms and accusing the export firms of dumping products into the domestic market. And there are a lot of technical issues involved. How do you define dumping? How do you gather? It's a matter of evidence. What are the facts? Do they support dumping? Whether it's the definition of selling at two different prices or selling below cost, it becomes a problem. If you want to make a lot of money, I suppose, in the world, go ahead and get some good training in international economics, and then get a law degree, and become a lawyer that deals with nothing other than dumping cases. Of course, you'd have to live in Washington, D.C. and be a high-stress life, and you'd die at 40. But you could, if you become an expert at international price discrimination and dumping, and there's demand for that sort of thing. Well, with that mumbling end, I think we'll stop there. I hope this has been of some value. I've spent more time on this lecture than I normally do. But I hope it's of some value. Good luck. If you have questions, send them along. Bye-bye.